Welcome to New Books in History. I am your host, Monica Black, and today I am talking to Jeff Bowersox, author of Raising Germans in an Age of Empire, Youth and Colonial Culture, 1871 to 1914. This very interesting book was just published this year by Oxford University Press. Raising Germans in an Age of Empire looks at colonial encounters, we might say, between young Germans and their nation's expanding overseas empire in the period from the founding of the German nation state in 1871 to the eve of the First World War in 1914. Jeff Bowersox is interested, in essence, in how young Germans were taught through toys, in schools, and in youth organizations like scouting troops, for example, to envision their empire, literally to imagine distant lands, exotic places, and peoples. His narrative takes shape over the period from the inception of the German Empire, when Germans and their leaders were notably ambivalent about the European project of overseas conquest, to the era of World War I, by which time an aggressive militaristic nationalism had developed not only in Germany but in other places too in Europe, in part as a result of the rivalry between various European powers for overseas expansion. This was an age in which, for example, the so-called scramble for Africa took place, when over a period of just a couple of decades, Africa went from being largely independent to being nearly totally colonized by various European powers, among them the Germans, of course, but also the British, the French, the Belgians, and other countries. This means, in fact, that the kinds of phenomena that Jeff looks at in this book were really, in some ways, replicated in many other European colonial powers. And so what he's talking about, the influences, the ways in which nationalist and imperialist pedagogues and the way that purveyors of colonialist kitsch were taking part in the attempt to influence young people concerning their empire and their place in the world, was something that took place in Germany, but it was also something that took place on a comparative scale in France and in Britain and in other places. This is what we see in Jeff's very interesting book is something that we could also see happening simultaneously in other European colonialist powers at the same time. So, Jeff, with that brief introduction, I want to thank you very much for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
It's lovely to talk to you. And we're actually, just for the sake of our listeners' interest, possibly, we're actually talking on a kind of transatlantic way, because I'm in the United States and you are in the UK. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I wonder if you could just tell us briefly a little bit about you and maybe, maybe a bit about your biography. And then sure. If you could use that to sort of then tell us a little bit also about how you came to this topic.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I'm in the UK now, although my accent suggests that I'm not originally from here. I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Worcester in the history department there, in Worcester in the UK, a position that I only just started 2 months ago, having been a research fellow at King's College before that, King's College London before that, and spending the previous 4 years before that at the University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg. So that's sort of my academic status, I suppose. This topic was originally my dissertation project at the University of Toronto, where I studied under Moder Sechsteins and Jim Retallack and Eric Jennings, who are professors there. And it's a topic that I guess you could say I came to in a sort of, I guess, sort of a crooked line brought me there, I suppose. I went to U of T interested in colonialism and in German history. That was something I knew I wanted. That's what I wanted to study. But actually, when I went there, I thought I was going to do it with relation to Eastern Europe as opposed to overseas things. Mm. But I quickly became interested in the growing literature at that time. This would have been 2001 is when I started there. The growing literature on German colonialism overseas, connected to Eastern Europe as well. But the overseas stuff was what was really fascinating me when I started putting together my research project. And I came to this sort of through a couple failed projects first. I had two or three other ideas that I would start on, only to realize that someone else had gotten there first. They were in the process of doing them right then. And so I had to keep sort of jumping from one sort of possible topic to another before I came to something that just hadn't been addressed at all, which was the experience of children and youth, which is an area in general that's understudied in German history. But with regard to colonialism, was entirely unstudied. So I was happy to be able to make a contribution to that. And it allowed me to sort of play with a lot of interesting, quirky sort of sources that I was looking forward to the challenge of trying to locate and then to try to interpret. So sort of institutional sort of sources, your archival stuff, published sources, that sort of thing. But then also material culture items like toys, games, and more inchoate things like movements themselves, which are sometimes very difficult to try to get a handle on. So that's how I sort of came to the topic itself.
Wonderful. That's very interesting. All of what you said is interesting. I mean, one of the things I thought that I appreciated about what you said was that, you know, and this has happened to lots of us over the course of our research lives, that you have a idea that you love and you think, oh boy, this is going to be it. And then you find out that someone else is working on it or that their approach might be quite similar to yours. And so you move on. But in fact, that, as you point out, sometimes those what appear at the moment to be failures or what appear at the moment to be failed projects actually turn out to be something really exciting and interesting.
Yeah, creative destruction in a sense.
That's exactly right. That, to use the parlance of our times, creative destruction.
Listening should take hope, because many, many, many of us have to go through this process at least once or twice or even three times in my own case. It doesn't have to be the end of your, you know, you may feel like it at the time when you discover that other book or project out there, but once you get over that disappointment, it can open up new opportunities that you hadn't quite imagined were possible before.
That's right. And I appreciate you saying that for our graduate students out there who are listening, that exactly that, you know, we can always find something. Sometimes our failed experiments will lead us to something quite new. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about, I mentioned in my kind of opening comments that there are aspects of what you've studied here in your book that have been studied in other contexts, though not in the German context. And I wanted to see if you could, maybe for our listeners who are less familiar with the area of imperialist history, you know, this sort of late 19th century, early 20th century phenomenon, if you could kind of place your work within the broader field and say a little bit about why empires become, this is something that you address in the introduction to your book, why empires become a matter of such interest in the last, I would say, 10 years, really specifically, about the time that you started in graduate school in 2001, the interest started to really rev up, and it has only continued to do so since. So the question I wanted to ask you was sort of why empire, if you could address that for our listeners.
Sure. I mean, it has a range of different origins, I suppose, but certainly within the last 10, 15, you can even push it back in some cases, 20 years or so at least. There's been a dual shift, if you will, to new topics and new approaches in history. One is what you might call, what many have called, sort of the cultural turn, which has opened up new ways, which is a way of looking at sort of mentalities and sort of social assumptions about how society should operate, reading between the lines of history, you could say, what people say and do, and trying to understand the sort of logic that underlies them and the ways that that people contest in those sorts of between the lines moments in a sort of anthropologically informed sort of way. So the cultural turn has opened up new sorts of sources to look at and new ways of addressing old questions like, why did colonialism happen? How did it affect Europeans, or how did Europeans affect the colonial spaces that they were ostensibly governing over? That's been one important influence on directing attention towards new types of sources that had been marginalized before, in particular sorts of trivial sources, or what had been considered trivial sources, like popular culture items, or even things that weren't considered high literature, high culture. And connecting to that has been a growing influence of post-colonial and colonial studies, studies that have been looking at sort of, you could say, they've been turning colonial history on its head. That is to say, instead of looking at the world as Europeans saw it, thinking about the way that the world might have looked differently if you weren't looking at it through what you might call a Eurocentric lens. So looking back at Europeans and understanding the way that the that the way that the Europeans looked at the rest of the world was part of how of a process, not just of thinking about the world, or even just sort of trying to justify colonial rule in a very cynical sort of way, but also a process of trying to construct themselves. That is, Europeans were looking out at the wider world in order to define themselves for themselves, and in a flattering way, perhaps, most often so. And this is something that helps Europeans understand themselves and also has consequences for the wider world that they're interacting with, especially when there's such disparities in power relations around the globe in precisely this time in the 19th and 20th centuries. And that's something that's that really began to shape historiography, especially in Britain, in the last 20 years or so. It kicked off in Germany in the late 90s or so. Really, it started to kick off in force, starting off with literary scholars and cultural studies scholars, first and foremost. But it's gradually shifted into more mainstream areas, or those avenues of inquiry have become more mainstream, become a more central player within the broader narratives of German history. Informed by what's going on in the historiography of, say, Britain, to a lesser degree, France, the U.S. as well, these sorts of cultural studies, post-colonial approaches, attentions to how racial hierarchies and such are constructed. These things have been imported, in a sense, into the German experience, but also, as I assume we'll talk about later on, when German scholars look at these sorts of approaches and apply them in the German case, it also helps us understand things operating a little differently and gives different perspectives on those same processes. So these are very much the process of encountering the wider world and trying to imagine your place within it, both to understand yourself and to operate when your various agents go out in the world. This is something that Germans are doing in concert with other Europeans and Americans around the world. But it's also something that Germans are doing in their own context as well. So it's both transnational and local, I guess, is the best transnational studies tend to be.
Yes. Sorry. No, I didn't mean to interrupt. I wanted to actually pick up on something that you just said, because I think you were thinking about going there, because I think this will be interesting too. If you can maybe talk a little bit about why historians of Germany have been a bit slower to recognize the importance of empire within German historiography and within German social history. The French and British literatures are deeper and older, as you noted, and maybe you can explain to our listeners a bit about why the German case is different.
Yeah. Well, I think you could break it down into two really simple reasons that are not really simple, but you can break them down very simply. Mm-hmm. One is the relatively short span of Germany's colonial rule overseas, and the second is the Holocaust and the Nazis. In the first case, Germany was only a state as a Germany from 1871, as you mentioned. Germany only took part in colonial expansion in a meaningful way. There were predecessors, but in any meaningful way, only beginning in the mid-1880s with the scramble for Africa. And Germany had a large colonial empire by comparison with other powers. It was third only behind France in terms of overseas possessions, territories in Africa, as you mentioned, what are today Tanganyika, the not Zanzibar, but the land part of Tanzania. Togo and Cameroon, what's today Namibia, was known as Southwest Africa back in the day. And then also possessions, a host of them, in the Pacific. Many of the islands that the U.S. now governs, including parts of Samoa, the Caroline Islands, the Marshall Islands, and a host of others, as well as parts of Papua New Guinea, were all German possessions, German colonies. And then also, of course, the Chinese port city of Qingdao. And if any of your listeners are familiar with Qingdao beer, then they'll be familiar with a German product that was produced under the German colonial empire and then taken over by later colonial powers, the Japanese, and then by the Chinese government after the Second World War. But anyway, that's a long way of saying Germany had many colonies, but they're all taken away after the First World War. In fact, they were lost within the earliest days of the First World War. And so many have used this sort of brevity to suggest that the colonies themselves didn't matter very much to Germans. And there's a lot of reasons you can make that argument. Perhaps we can talk about that more in a second. So that's one reason why. The second reason is that the Germans have a very specific experience with the Second World War around National Socialism and the Holocaust that justifiably, I should note, takes up a lot of the energy of German history. The Holocaust and the Nazis are the focal point of modern German historiography for obvious reasons. And what that means is that when trying to talk about the things that matter in German history, usually if we can connect them to the Nazis and the Holocaust in some way, they become of greater importance. Mm. And because the Nazis, their own overseas plans were relatively limited, certainly compared to their continental ambitions, that it has been seen by many and still is seen by many as of secondary importance at the very least, or at the very most, and perhaps even of tertiary or more lower importance there. And if you compare that with, for example, the experience of Britain and France with decolonization, the empire striking back, so to speak, and post-colonial migration, those processes have created large and visible populations whose experiences don't gel so much with the longer resident populations of Britain and France, and whose experiences derive in many ways directly from the imperial experience. And that's a challenge for historians to draw back those histories into the imperial era and the imperial context in Britain and France, and to use them to explain things that are going on today, to draw along continuities. And because Germany's post-colonial migration, what you might call that, comes from Southern Europe, comes from Turkey, comes from not Germany's colonies as a whole. Even more recent migrants from Africa are not largely coming from Germany's colonies. They're coming from other places that Germany didn't have as direct a connection with. Because of that, there's been a disconnect between populations of minorities in Germany and colonial rule that was broken off a century ago. I think if you put those two things together, it helps explain why there's been so much less attention among historians, certainly, as well as among the public as well. There's what many have called a sort of colonial amnesia that is being undone through some very good work by historians and by popular historians and journalists to try to make Germans more aware of what their experience in the age of European empire was about, and how it might have, in fact, long-term continuities into the Nazi era and indeed into the post-war and Berlin Republic eras.
Yes, that's very interesting, and I really appreciate your giving our listeners that background and a sense of historiographical placing for your work. I think that's really useful, and I wonder now if you can sort of follow up on that by explaining what was it that you found so important about looking at children and the experience of youth in the context of the creation of a colonial imaginary. And I'll also say something about the fact that you mention early on in the book, I can't quite remember exactly where, but I know that you mention the important fact that Germany was demographically a very, very young country in the period of its colonial expansion. So if you could maybe talk about that demographic reality and how that shaped how that shaped the sense that youth were sort of very important, that it was very important to reach youth in particular ways and to teach them about the world through the kinds of media that you look at in the book. And, of course, we'll talk about this media in more detail in a few minutes.
Sure. Well, I mean, Germany was experiencing demographically a baby boom before the First World War. The percentage of the population that was youth in Germany was greater at that point than at any time since. And so Germany itself was very young. Many of the leading figures of Germany were also relatively young. If you think about, for example, Kaiser Wilhelm II, who came to power in 1888, he styled himself as very young. And he wasn't so young by 1914, but certainly for much of his reign, he styled himself as not a sort of graybeard, not even a sort of middle-aged, respectable guy, but as a young, sort of fiery, sort of active force pushing Germany forward into the future. And he cultivated this image of youth an image which fit not just with a Germany that's demographically young, but a Germany that's also politically young, because, of course, the German state was only founded in 1871. And so that sort of sense of Germany as an unfinished project, or as a project just begun, perhaps, played into the same sense that you now have to sort of build the nation. And not everyone was clear on exactly what that would mean, what sort of Germany was going to be built, and what sort of Germany, sort of thinking outside of German borders, how that Germany is going to relate to the wider world. And with the extraordinary expansion of the German economy at the same time, the extraordinary expansion of German population at the same time, there's a sense of vitality that pervades a lot of German society, and certainly a lot of cultural commentary at the time. If you're thinking of the more optimistic cultural commentators, there's a lot of hope that this young, vibrant, active Germany, with a large population of young people, led by many young people, could use that energy to perhaps challenge the older, more established powers. And if not everyone was thinking of this in terms of outright conflict that we often think about, we often think about Anglo-German rivalry, for example, as a sort of fight to the death sort of thing. But a lot of people were thinking of it in more benign ways, as a sort of reviving European civilization, that Germany had an important contribution to make to that, and that gaining the place in the sun for many was Germany taking on its rightful place, but also its necessary place to make sure that the older established powers weren't static, so to speak, that Germany can really help modernize, something that, by the way, commentators in Britain and France often commented on, the modernity of the German economy, of German science, German culture, even in the colonial context as well. So this is something that there's this atmosphere of youth and activity in Germany anyway. And if you combine that with the sense that Germany has to sort of prepare itself for the modern age in the face of tremendous challenges which are brought about by this, precisely the same things that were making them so active, this modern economy, the industrial economy in particular, it was creating enormous wealth. It was creating enormous power, military, industrial, economic, trade terms and such. But it was also causing lots of problems. It was creating an urban proletariat. It was creating massive cities with inner city troubles, poverty, people crammed into unhealthy places. There was a concern about hygiene. People were worried about education, the way that an industrial sort of education was not focused on inspiring imaginations and learning, but more on rote memorization, what they called the memory cram. Just forcing students to spit back mechanically, or even like well-drilled soldiers, just facts and figures that they couldn't actually put into practice. These, of course, are ideas that probably don't seem too out of place today in some senses. And so there's a lot of concern that as Germany is being vibrant and expanding, that the raw material of Germany, the Germans themselves, wouldn't be up to the task, that the very source of their prosperity, in particular the Industrial Revolution and everything that comes along with it, was also undermining that future prosperity by creating a mass of worn out, uninventive, uncreative, even misled Germans. And of course, among that, if you're thinking about how you're going to raise the nation and make it powerful, not just now, but in the future, then you have to start paying attention to young people who were, at this point, many of them were working, but also they're beginning to be paid more attention to as the tools for building that future German nation that can compete on the global stage in this industrial age.
Yes. Yes. That's all very interesting what you were saying. I always find this era of German history and of European history generally to be one of the most fascinating for precisely the reasons that you pointed out. I mean, this tremendous, tremendous economic expansion and the effects that was having on cities, and then the effects that those effects on cities, urbanization, for example, were having on the way that people thought about the world, and all kinds of new ideas emerging, some of them quite scary, some of them very interesting, of course.
Yeah.
But in any case, I that that all of that resonated with me. And I appreciate you giving us some insights there about the connection between, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I should add one point in as well.
That yes, please.
Really important to note. While this is all going on, the very notion of youth and childhood was being invented by cultural critics and sociologists of the time. So this is an important context as well, that the idea that there is a stage of human development that starts from the youngest of ages and goes up till the time when people go out of the house, and that this has to be somehow protected, that this stage has very specific intellectual processes that are different from those of adults, and those people, those little people, up to adolescence, have thus special needs that are different and have to be cultivated in a way to make them effective adults. This idea was being invented around this time. And this is part of the context well for understanding this, that one of the concerns about the industrial age was that it was going to drill out this more or less newly discovered or rediscovered idea of childhood and youthful imagination and creativity and spontaneity and all these things that we tend to associate with young people today. These are things that a whole range of academics and others were first becoming first starting to think about as a framework for understanding how to deal with these people, young people. And so this also plays into it, that there's a sort of reshaping our worldview that, of course, still goes on till the present day.
Yes, and of course, this is also the moment when, as you suggest, a lot of what we would now think of as the social sciences are forming and are finding new places to look at the human condition and trying to understand the way that the changes that you talked about, industrialization, massive economic expansion, overseas colonization, were influencing human communities and trying to get at all of that stuff. And then, of course, the very important role that, as you point out again, the reinvention of childhood in this moment had. And on that particular note, on the note of the reinvention of childhood, I think one of my favorite chapters in your book was chapter one, actually, on toys. And so now maybe I thought we could segue into talking a bit about the various media and forms of material culture that you look at in your book. And maybe if you could speak with us a little bit about what that chapter on toys is about, how you used toys as a kind of as a window onto aspects of what you refer to in various points, and other people have referred to also as the colonial imaginary.
Well, essentially, the chapter surveys the way that producers of various sorts tried to appeal to what they thought young people wanted to play with. This is an era of mass consumer culture, among other, another context, necessary context we have to include in the conversation. This is an era when young people as the targets of producers is also, when children first became a target for producers, across the scales of income, from the lowest classes up to the highest classes. And along with this, there was an interest in trying to appeal to what they thought young people wanted. And among those things were an interest in the exotic, an interest in worlds beyond their own experiences, an interest in places where they could sort of experience a sense of autonomy, a sense of adventure, a sense of being something more than they were, of developing themselves as individuals through their imaginations. And producers played to this idea by producing, by sort of reproducing the wider world and delivering it to kids through a whole host of means, through all kinds of sorts of toys, from sort of elaborate board games to mechanical tin toys, very complicated, many of them, machinery, sort of wind-up toy that does a dance for you or wanders around and does something funny for you. Also through tin soldiers, through which you could reproduce many of the colonial events happening around you. In fact, they were called newspapers in tin because it was presumed that because they could be reproduced so quickly, they were on shelves within weeks of an event happening, like a military campaign happening, a war happening, or a major event of an explorer doing something or other. They can get on the store shelves very, very quickly. And so it was presumed that kids were playing with them while their parents were reading about them in the papers. You know, they could even actually have a conversation about world events through these forms. Sort of plush toys as well, the sort of things that kids would go to sleep with at night, could be reproduced in some way. And then various sorts of figurines, whether in early plastics or paper cutouts as well. But these are all things that producers began trying to sell on a massive scale to kids, beginning really the sort of 1860s, but in the 1870s. In a sort of process of, I mean, some of it's sort of a process of experimentation, right? What will sell? But it was presumed that as everyone else in society seemed to be interested in the sort of European expansion, in strange and wonderful creatures who look strange and wonderful, that children would be too, especially because parents are buying the objects for them, by and large. And so there develops this huge market in toys in general, but also a sub-market within that for colonial characters and settings. And as I mentioned, these cover mostly the areas where stuff is happening around the world. India, a lot of Africans represented, the American Wild West, anywhere where Europeans, or white people, I should say, because it's not just Europeans, where white people are encountering non-white people, anywhere where there are strange and curious environments that don't look quite like what kids in Germany might recognize as familiar. These are ripe for exploitation by producers who put them together in all sorts of curious ways, because of course the point for producers wasn't just to reproduce the world as it actually was, although they often advertised their products as being authentic. The point was to catch people's eye. It was to try to get attention in a shop window and to cause a purchaser to buy their item over someone else's item. Right? This is a very competitive market. And so they would pick up not just sensational things, but sensational things that were, or things presented sensationally, but things presented sensationally to suit the most current of events. And more than that, they would try to produce things that were produced sensationally to match current events and offered in some curious or unique way, perhaps, mixing and matching things in a way that could cause a parent to buy that item over the one next to it that reproduces more or less what it does in all its details. And so kids end up getting colonial soldiers, for example. They could buy your colonial soldiers with your various sorts of native savages. You could, sometimes they're mixed and matched. Sometimes the colonial environments are mixed and matched. And so one of my favorite examples of this is a tin toy set that has what appears to be it's an elephant with a white hunter on it, with Indian assistance of a sort, and it includes an African tiger that has also found a zebra to eat. And so somehow we've got Indian characters with an African zebra thrown together in the same set, and it's all supposed to make sense. And it's not accurate, but it makes sense because these are all supposed to be sort of members of that same other world out there where you can mix and match things without anyone throwing up too much of a fuss, because the point isn't necessarily accuracy if you're a producer or a commercial producer, if you're a kid. The point is to allow for imaginative play. And that's what, on the commercial end, what producers were trying to accomplish and get across to the kids.
Is to give that space for fantasy.
That's right, yeah. To feed that sort of youthful fantasy, which is becoming something that commentators are increasingly commenting on, or are increasingly trying to get people to talk about. And this, of course, produces... I try to make two points about this, two other points about this, and that is that on the one hand, this provokes, among a lot of critical commentators, a lot of criticism that children are being exploited, they're being manipulated by these cynical commercial producers, and they're not being taught things effectively, that producers are just sort of throwing junk at them and not giving them a proper understanding of the wider world. And thus, when these kids grow up, they're going to have a totally misshapen understanding of how the world operates. They're going to think it's all about sensational, crazy folk and crazy animals and crazy landscapes, without knowing that one particular character, say an Indian in this example, is different from an African, is different from a Native American, is different, and that all those different contexts are actually quite different and require different strategies if you're going to interact with them in a meaningful way as an adult. And so critical commentators and educational reformers start trying to themselves enter into the commercial market to intervene in mass commerce in order to produce more responsible, more authoritative ways or accurate ways to try to represent the colonial world, but without losing that fun, without losing the imaginative potential, which they saw as essential to kids learning in the modern age. And so you have this really interesting sort of dynamic where you have lots and lots of producers who are producing things primarily to catch people's eye and to sell them at the highest price they can justify. But then you have all these critical commentators who are bearing down on them, saying you can't exploit the children, you can't mislead the children, which then causes them to adjust their commercial tactics, try to make them more educationally responsible. And in fact, if you could do that, you could even get them into the schools. And so really, really savvy producers could use their product, could shape their products in such a way to not give up that sort of sensational appeal and make them just educational enough to get them into classrooms and presumably to make more money in the process. And at the same time, but then you've got, of course, the kids who themselves are trying to find something fun to play with. And in many of the studies that explore how these toys actually operated, especially an older generation of studies, I should note, it was sort of assumed that these sorts of products just imposed on kids a worldview, that they imposed on them whatever the commercial producers wanted them to see, whatever the education reformers wanted them to see, and that kids had no agency in this. But if you look at their memoirs, if you look at their recollections on their childhood, peoples as they grew up, looking back on their childhood from this era, if you look at even contemporary studies of the time, it becomes apparent that kids are actually quite savvy about trying to figure out what to do with these toys. They often ignored the intended messages that were embedded in them. Some of these toys came in with really tendentious lessons about patriotic lessons and sort of teaching you how to play with them in order to make you into a good, educated sort of German, and to sort of discipline you in that way. And so kids were often just take the toys, throw the rule book out, and then play with them in their own way. They'd mix and match their different toys together. So toy products that were themselves often mixed and matched, kids often actually mixed and matched even more so. You know, they'd take a board game that was actually quite boring and throw out the board and just keep all the little tin pieces. And they'd take them over and they'd make their own world and have their own little their own battles and their own negotiations. They'd make their cowboys and Indians run over the couch, essentially, and try to sort of get what they wanted out of the toys. And what they seemed to want was this space for adventure and developing autonomy. And when I try to draw conclusion I try to draw from this is that over the course of this period, over the course of the imperial era, as people try to get kids to buy products or get families to buy products for kids and get kids trained to be good Germans who have a body of knowledge that's useful later on, who know how to operate in the wider world, they try to sort of send messages down the line to kids. And those messages are often framed in terms of a colonial order, that there's a civilized world, there's an uncivilized world. The former has a responsibility to help out or otherwise change the latter. And kids often got rid of those messages. They often didn't listen to what they were being told, per se. And yet, as they tried to appropriate these items for their own uses, for their imaginative play, they often ended up reinforcing that exact same binary. And so, because if what they wanted was an adventurous landscape, something different from what they were used to, something different from the streets of their city or town, something different from the schoolroom or their job if they're teenagers, what they often would do was imagine the colonial world as the exact opposite, as a disorderly space, as an underdeveloped place, as a place inhabited by strange and wonderful people who could facilitate adventures, their own sort of heroic adventures, their own efforts to shape the landscape, to grapple with a landscape that needed grappling with, like their heroic adventures. Explorers had done so before them. And so even though kids are often rejecting the basic lessons that are being tried, that adults are trying to sort of push down to them, they're often reinforcing that broader worldview, that broader colonial mindset that sees the wider world as a place for intervention, as a place that is, in some sense, in need of intervention, which by 1940, I think this isn't necessarily the case in 1880 or 1870, but by 1914, this is clearly developed in a sense that very few are challenging this idea, which I think has consequences for how we understand what Germans are thinking about at the time, up to 1914. But it also gives us something to talk about in terms of continuities. Once Germany's lost its colonial empire, then they haven't lost this colonial mindset, and it carries on in a way that is different from other colonial powers because they still have their empires, but in many ways maintains the same sort of structures up through the Nazi era, and I would argue even into the post-war era, with continuities into the present day.
That's really interesting. Yeah, maybe at some point you and I can speak further about your thoughts about the post 1945 era, because I would be interested to know your thoughts about that. But for now, I wonder if on this theme of, I was very fascinated by what you were saying about a sort of sense of adventure and the way that an imaginative play, the way that kids appropriated toys and used them for their own imaginative to create their own imaginative landscapes of adventure and what have you, and the intersection between that and commerce and pedagogy. And I wondered if on that note of sort of the intersection between kids' desire for adventure and maybe adults' desire to instruct, as we're wont to do, if you could talk a little bit about the chapter on scouting, mm-hmm. because I also found that very interesting.
Yeah, well, this is, I was very pleased that I was able to do this chapter, because it was, when I had the idea for it, I didn't imagine there was enough material available, because the scouts themselves were only founded in Britain in 1907, 1908, 1909 or so. In 1909, it's transported over to Germany in a sense. So it's only 5 years of history, really, that I'm writing in that chapter. And yet, once I was able to find the material, thanks to, I should note, a very generous collector named Stefan Schrollkamp in Berlin, without whom that chapter would not have been possible, it becomes clear that we have a movement organized around the idea of colonial spaces as spaces for personal development, and that the entire Boy Scout movement in Britain under Baden-Powell is developed along these lines. This purpose is to develop a core of youth who, being borne down by the weight of industrial society, to sort of lift them back up so that they can be effective imperial agents in the future and sort of serve the British Empire, as Baden-Powell had been had experienced in the South African War. And this idea appealed to German veterans in particular, this German Southwest African War, which took place only a couple of years after the Boer War concluded. Named Alexander Leon and Maximilian Bayer. They had the same sort of fears. They had experienced raw recruits arriving in Southwest Africa who they felt had no idea how to survive, that they were essentially urbanites or physically incapable, not creative enough to figure out how to enter a new landscape and make use of the resources that were available to them. And even if they had been physically capable of it, a lot of them, they felt, didn't have the curiosity and the creativity to figure it out. And so they found in Baden-Powell's project a tool for accomplishing this purpose. And they worked very, very diligently to try to build up a movement, because the Boy Scouts were very popular in Britain from the start. And they started trying to sort of adapt it for the German audience, but they didn't end up changing very much of it. They substantially plagiarized, with Baden-Powell's permission, the programs of it. And it proved to be quite successful among a lot of Germans, German youth, boys and girls, mostly boys, but boys and girls, who it seems were fired by that exact same notion that the colonial space is somewhere where you can go and have adventures and where you can develop yourself as an autonomous individual growing into adulthood. And they were pretty successful at it. and inspiring kids in this way and using that as a pedagogical tool, as you mentioned rightly. And yet, they were stymied in a way that Baden-Powell didn't have to worry about by commentators and very powerful politicians in Germany who looked with great suspicion upon the, they were called the Pathfinders, on the Pathfinder Project. They saw it as a as an English import, as an expression of Anglophilia. And if you were a conservative nationalist, sort of an aggressively chauvinistic nationalist, then England is your bete noire, and you don't really want to import anything from liberal England. And they attached to this project all kinds of ideas about how it would mislead Germany's youth. It taught them to take their eye off of the prize, so to speak, that is developing German military virtues, as opposed to running around playing with the savages. And so they actually orchestrated a campaign to try to get the Pathfinders and their leader, Alexander Leon, who not coincidentally was also Jewish, to basically get him run out of the organization, to have the organization itself subsumed within a broader German militaristic youth movement that was also developing at the same time. And this conflict I found myself most interesting, and I spent a good bit of time outlining how it actually worked out, because it took place over a few years. And essentially, the founders of the Pathfinders, Leon and Beyer in particular, kept trying to essentially remove themselves from their English model. And they did this in various sort of cynical ways, and also sort of superficial ways. They changed the illustrations in the Pathfinder book, for example, to make it not be so many English ones. They changed some of the captions so that it wasn't so clear they were from the British original. They removed some stories from it as well. They changed the narrative about where the Pathfinders actually came from, acknowledging that Baden-Powell had created the movement in Britain, but that, of course, Baden-Powell had been inspired by German forebears before that. And all in this effort to sort of make the Pathfinders appear, at least superficially, more like a movement rooted in the German nation, as opposed to a movement that, for the founders, was very much a cosmopolitan movement. And for them, they were Anglophiles, but they were thinking about a broader cosmopolitan colonizing community, one that Brits and Germans and French and Americans and basically anyone who had civilizing capacity, read mostly white, could join together, go into the colonial space, this undeveloped, unruly space, and there develop the capacity needed to shape the modern world. You couldn't do this back at home in the metropole. You had to be out in the colonial space, grappling with nature, grappling with the indigenous inhabitants in order to be successful in the modern world. Instead of that vision, the Pathfinders are forced to increasingly compromise their vision to make it more narrowly German, exclusively German. And so they have to, and they sort of in the process undermine that pedagogy. They undermine the value of that adventurous landscape. And so in all of their official materials, they are repeatedly forced to take this idea of a universal colonial world out there where they can all develop and talk instead about inherent German virtues, that it's not the colonial space that changes you, it's your Germanness that you take to the colonial space that matters. And in many ways, this makes the German Pathfinders very different from the British model that they had built out of. And it also makes them, I think, much less successful on the whole. Now, while a lot of kids would have been using older materials, on the whole, the Pathfinders remained far less popular in Germany than they were in Britain. They were still a large part of the German youth movement and an important part, but they were by no means the wildly successful mass movement that scouting in Britain remained. And in large part, that's because of the opposition that forced them to compromise, I think, on these basic appeals that had grown out of commercial culture, that had grown out of reform pedagogy, but had also appealed very much to young people themselves. And this causes after the war, the Pathfinders themselves split apart into all kinds of splinter movements and such, you know, into a form that isn't brought back together again until after the Second World War.
Thank you, Jeff, for explaining that. I did find that chapter particularly interesting, and the arguments particularly interesting too. I wonder if, you know, I guess that one question I'd like to ask you, which I enjoy asking authors generally, is maybe as a we'll talk about some other things in just a moment. We'll talk about what you're working on next, and we'll all be very interested to know what we can expect from you in a next project. But maybe before we get to that, one last question about your current, about the book that's just come out that I would like to ask you, because I like to ask people this question generally, is how do you feel? What do you feel was the most important conclusion that you reached in your book, or what for you was the most striking thing that you learned in the course of your research and then in writing the book?
So the thing that I try to emphasize most about the book's argument, what I think is the most important case that it makes, is that essentially the way Germans understood themselves was centrally bound up with the idea that they live within a world defined into those who were civilized and those who were uncivilized. And this was central to how Germans imagined they would fit in the modern world, not just within Europe, but around the globe. And that this was not something that just was about attention to their own colonies. If you asked a German what they thought about Togo, they probably couldn't tell you very much. But rather, this was a broader worldview that encompassed the entire globe, not just Germany's colonies, but indeed the British Empire, which they're constantly talking about. Areas that aren't part of any formal empire, like South American jungles, the American Wild West, which fits into empire in an entirely different way than a lot of European colonial projects, than those projects are defined. And that this particular worldview was pervasive and important to Germans. Not the only thing they thought about, obviously, but it was centrally tied up with how Germans thought about modernity by 1914. And that this idea came not so much from the top down. This wasn't something that was cynically imposed by Bismarck and later politicians trying to manipulate the public. But it happened just as much from the bottom up through the means of mass commercial culture, which operated on an entirely different set of principles than did political propaganda, and indeed often drove the political propaganda. The colonials' propagandists were often chasing behind developments in mass culture more than they were actually directing those developments in mass culture. And so I think that's the point that I would highlight as the most important. It helps us understand how Germans thought about themselves in a global context in terms of empire, not just their own, but everyone's. And it also helps understand a new set of media for talking about that where Germans were having this conversation with themselves in the sphere of mass commercial culture, which rises at the very same time as this imperial expansion happens. And if we think about that broader argument, then it really gives us something to say about how Germans were part of a broader project, as we mentioned at the very opening of this interview, in a broader project that was taking place in Britain and France and the US and many other places around the globe. Because the mass commercial culture that Germans were engaging with was in many ways connected to, in fact, the same commercial culture that was going on in Britain or France or the US. German toys, the same toys that German kids played with, were dominating the toy market in Britain and the United States. German and American and British kids were playing with a lot of the same toys. French films, when films were introduced, French film companies were enormously effective at exporting those films around. So films of exotic imagery, for example, were bouncing all over the place. Germany didn't have its own Rudyard Kipling, but Germans read Rudyard Kipling, as did everyone else, in translation. And so there's an international commercial market in literature as well, in exoticized and colonial literature. And so this is something that I only hint at really in the book. And I think there's a lot more room for this sort of, for attention to this sort of connection, this sort of transnational colonial culture, which hasn't really been done in any meaningful way yet. Talking about how it is that Germans and British and French and Americans and Austrians and Scandinavians and people who don't have colonial empires or meaningful ones of their own were all part of a broader network, in commercial terms as well as other terms, where they're all constructing a broader frame for understanding how the world should operate, at least up to 1914 anyway. For Germany, things changed dramatically after that point. But up to 1914, I think we can talk about a broader transnational commercial culture that helped shape how Europeans and North Americans, among others, saw themselves in the colonial world.
Jeff, you've been very generous with your time, and I've so appreciated hearing your thoughts on your book and hearing you explain some of its main arguments and some of your discussion of your sources and so on. We know that we can't talk to you forever today. I mean, you've got lots of other things to do, and we don't want to take up any more of your time. But we do want to ask you one last question, which will interest all of our listeners, I expect. And that's, maybe you could tell us a bit about what you are working on now. Are you, is this transnational aspect of Imperial Media, let's say, is that a next project, or are you working on something quite different?
It's actually related directly to this. It came out of the Toys chapter, my next project, my current project, actually. When I discovered among the various sort of colonial toys the Germans were playing with, there were a lot of American minstrel characters, which I didn't at all expect and didn't quite know how to explain. And it turns out, there's not much literature on this, which is why I'm doing this as my next project. It turns out that from the 1870s, there were a goodly number of American blackface performers, as well as a lot of African-American performers who were coming over from the U.S., many of whom would stop in Britain, and then touring the continent, and including Germany. And a lot of them would even settle down in Germany. And so Germany is linked into one of these broader commercial networks, in this case, a commercial network in mass popular entertainment, variety shows, vaudeville. An international circuit of entertainers are traveling across the Atlantic and all around the continent, from, you know, Birmingham to Bologna and Moscow to Madrid. They're just traveling all over the continent. And these entertainers, these black entertainers, mostly African-Americans, although there's some Afro-Caribbeans, there's some Africans pretending to be African-Americans. So it's understood as something that's an African-American entertainment anyway in Germany. They're inspiring a host of popular entertainment trends. So before jazz, this is the era of ragtime. This is the era of the cakewalk, the two-step, the turkey trot, the Boston, dance steps like these. And these are all taking Germany, as in much the rest of Europe, by storm, and provoking some conversations within German society about what it means to be taking on and dancing, literally embodying, if you're dancing, the dance forms of black people in a white Germany. What it means to be going to watch African-American singers sing about the plantation South, and to sing about race relations, and to just sing funny songs, even to sing German songs on German stages. This provokes conversation among Germans about what commercial culture, or what it means to be German in an age when anybody, it seems, can reproduce those German songs. What I'm trying to understand is how questions of race operate in this context. In fact, my sort of working thesis is that the commentary on this sort of entertainment is one of the ways by which modern notions of race, and in particular American notions of race, sort of breaking down between white and black in particular, that this is one important means by which Germans came to understand how race operated on an everyday level. That we can talk about the racial theorists, we can talk about the scientists, we can talk about how that filtered down in popular science or even made its way into children's textbooks, as I write about in this book. But going to see black entertainers on the variety stage and then 2 days later reading about it in the newspaper, that I think there is a way we haven't really understood yet to understand how Germans before the jazz age, before the age of Josephine Baker, were already thinking about what blackness and whiteness meant and what Germanness versus Americanness meant. And especially with regard to commercial culture, which made it all a bit certainly more sensational, but also a bit more problematic for those who worried about material, sort of materialism in the modern age.
Sounds just fascinating, Jeff. Thank you very much for explaining that. We'll all be looking forward to seeing what you'll do next with that topic and with other things, I expect.
Thanks.
The book we've been talking about today is Raising Germans in the Age of Higher Youth and Colonial Culture, 1871 to 1914, by Jeff Bowersox. It was just published this year by Oxford University Press. I hope you'll run right out and buy it, or at least read it. It is fascinating. There are many, I found just among the many things that Jeff's talked about today, one of the things I found fascinating was just literally to look at his sources, which you can't always say about every history book you read, right? So I loved looking at some of the reproductions of the sources in the book, and it's a fascinating book and makes some really important, I think, and interesting arguments. So Jeff, thanks so much again, and we're going to sign off and say goodbye.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Monica. I really appreciate it.